following is a Travel Channel feature presentation.
I'm John Ratzenberger. On this Made in America, we travel to the great state of Illinois and hitch a ride at the Caterpillar Tractor Factory. We go north a little ways to Wisconsin and walk a mile in a pair of Allen Edmonds shoes. And then in Minnesota, we check in at the Medtronic factory that keeps our hearts from missing a beat.
And then breathe fire in the state of Tabasco.
I've been all over this great country, in small towns and big cities, visiting factories and workshops, searching for the soul of America. And you know what? I found it everywhere. So sit back and relax, because we've got it made in America. Ever since I was a tadpole, I've loved to watch construction sites, the bigger, the better. All those people coming and going, working as a team in the service of something great. My favorite part of the process is at the beginning, when the powerful Caterpillar earth movers clear and level the land. The way I see it, caterpillars are to earth what paintbrushes are to canvas. Between Chicago and St. Louis lies a place whose very name is synonymous with mainstream America. Peoria, Illinois has the kind of diversity and demographics that make it a good microcosm of the rest of the country, which is why professional marketers know that if it plays here, it'll play everywhere. So it's fitting that Peoria is home to a company which is synonymous with constructing the American dream. You see, when it comes to the essentials of building, Caterpillar has something for every job. But before these machines can go to work constructing, they have to undergo some construction of their own. Jerry Shaheen is a Caterpillar group president.
Who came up with the name Caterpillar?
The inventor of the crawler tractor, Benjamin Holt, introduced the first model the first time. One of his employees was with him, and he's the one that looked at the machine at that time. He said, you know, that's just like a caterpillar crawling, and that became the name of the product and eventually the name of the company, and it has served us very well.
It's because it didn't move like a monkey.
It didn't move. Yeah. Absolutely.
With over $30 billion a year in sales and 76,000 employees, Caterpillar is a genuine American success story. That story begins in the 1890s when two competitors, Daniel Best and the aforementioned Benjamin Holt, each began tinkering with steam-driven tractors. By 1904, Holt had perfected a design that used tracks instead of wheels, thus launching the modern era of heavy machinery. By 1906, Best had perfected a gasoline-powered version and advanced the art of construction science even further. And by 1925, the two rivals had decided that they were better off as allies. So they merged their companies and formed a brand that has grown ever since and provided a happy home to generations of American workers.
I've been at Caterpillar 38 years, and I'm not any different than most of our employees. Most of us come here out of college or high school, and we stay here for our career. And that's one of the strengths of our company is longevity.
Caterpillar's people literally move mountains, and Caterpillar tries to return the favor. The company's appreciation for its workforce is etched in stone.
150,000 more or less people that have worked at some point in time in this complex at Caterpillar. There's my name.
Well, look at that.
And I'm very proud about being listed on this wall with these people.
It's all about the people.
It's all about the people.
Their people turn out dozens of bulldozers a day, from the mid-size D6 to the colossal D11. And every one of them starts off as a hunk of steel, identifiable only by its signature yellow color. Assembly support manager Tom Simmons spells out the ABCs of his operation.
The higher the number, the bigger the tractor.
Higher the number, the bigger the tractor.
And what's the D stand for?
Diesel.
Diesel!
What you're looking at right now is essentially it's a skeleton of the tractor.
That's some serious welding.
Some
there.
Serious
I've never,
welding.
I've never
there.
Seen beads that thick.
Frame welding is done in a nearby building by both humans and robots. In another building, masses of steel are heated, sliced, and stamped by a massive 6,000-ton press, all in preparation for becoming links in the long tracks that keep these machines moving over any terrain. The links are joined, then rolled up and sent to the assembly building, where workers are already fitting other pieces of the tractor. Caterpillar bulldozers begin as hunks of steel that are transformed by machines and people who have a legendary dedication to their work. But now the question is, if these bulldozers move on tracks, what moves the tracks?
D11 tractor. It might not look like it now, but you're installing the final drive right now. Final drive is going to provide power to drive the chain and actually to operate the tractor.
The frame is lifted onto a conveyor belt where it moves along at incredible speed. That is, if you're a snail, or come to think of it, a caterpillar.
What that does is that makes sure a tractor moves off our line every 42 minutes. That's about 8 inches per minute.
With new parts added on at each station, the frame soon begins to look less like an amorphous mass and more like a real tractor.
Although, what are the pedals for?
What you have on the right side isn't an accelerator, it's a decelerator.
What's the big pedal for?
It's a brake. Don't need that too much.
Though the conveyor ride is over, the machines are still missing their tracks and cabs and a few other important parts. Those come after they're separated by model number.
Look at the size of those chains. You ever take out a tooth with one of these?
We've just wrapped the chain, and the last piece here, it's called a master link. It's how they service track in the field. That's what holds the two links together. They're going to put a master shoe on, and then you're going to run down the bolts.
Now that's an industrial sound, isn't it?
Putting track on a tractor is a really important stage of the production process. This is really the first time that the tractor is able to operate on its own power. Skirting a 250,000-pound tractor around the facility is a little tough, use and hoist. And now we get it on track, we can take her wherever we want to.
The yellow giant moseys over to the final assembly phase, where it's outfitted with quite possibly its most important component, the seat. After all, comfortable drivers are happy drivers. The tractors are washed before being driven onto railroad cars for the trip to anywhere. Caterpillar has dealers in dozens of countries and customers in nearly all the rest. Now, if you're interested in a test drive before buying, there's only one place where the lucky few are invited to take these honeys out for a spin or a push. The Caterpillar Proving Grounds.
It's like every kid's sandbox dream.
Now that was a real earth-moving, earth-shaking experience. Just north of Milwaukee along Lake Michigan lies Port Washington, a town whose small size belies the fact that it's home to more pre-Civil War buildings than anywhere else in Wisconsin. It also boasts North America's first man-made harbor. One other thing about Port Washington stands out. Literally, this is where Allen Edmonds Shoes keeps America and the world on their feet. Whether you're out in the town or along on a stroll, it's the shoes that make the man. And at Allen Edmonds, men and women make the shoes. American men and women, that is. Which is a fact of increasing rarity. Sadly, we now import an astonishing 95% of our footwear. So it's a particular delight to see these people hard at work. And just as surprising to see that the president and CEO, John Stoltenwerk, still greets customers here in the company store.
Always like a nice pair of shoes. You know, I'm really fussy about my shoes and what I put on my feet. Like the ones that...
Excuse me?
Apparently, President Stoltenwerk still has the salesman's touch. Ah, so many choices, but so few feet.
These are nice shoes you have on, John.
Yeah, thank you very much.
What are those called?
Those are the Fairfax.
Do you get to name them?
Style. We use an Atlas all
do you really?
The time.
Ooh-wee! Happy feet!
I tell you, I feel really snappy.
Yeah, right. You look snappy.
I want to go to a race course. Go to Vegas.
Right.
Really snappy here.
Allen Edmonds' focus has been on comfort ever since its founder, Albert W. Allen, pioneered a 200-step shoemaking process and adopted the ad slogan, "The shoe that needs no breaking in." That was in 1922, and the company still uses the same process today. In the late 20s, Allen brought in a partner, William Edmonds, and thus was born this iconic brand. It's probably good that John Stoltenwerk didn't add his name to the company when he bought it in 1980. He did, though, build a factory here in Port Washington after a fire destroyed the original one in Belgium, 10 miles north.
How is it that you've survived in face of all the competition from China and everybody
else? John, we've done it really on quality, service, and integrity, but especially on quality. I mean, our quality is unsurpassed.
Don't forget comfort. Never forget comfort. Jim Cass is Allen Edmonds' director of operations.
So this is where it all really starts for the shoes here. All the leather comes in here. This is all European calfskin here.
This is where my shoes started.
That's where
huh?
I started.
From the storage area, the skids, as the pieces are called, are taken to the cutters. Sue here has 18 years of practice at getting the greatest number of cuts out of each skid. After all, premium shoe leather is a terrible thing to waste. Obviously, each style of shoe requires a different cut. This shoe that Sue's working on has three main parts.
The tip, the vamp, and the apron collar.
And the apron collar, right.
We don't want to do that because you're wasting all this leather, so we have to get it real close to the edge. Right, Sue?
Right. That's perfect.
That works? Okay.
Right. Good job. Oh.
Once the tips, vamps, and apron collars have been cut, they're sewn together to become what's called the shoe's upper. A little flame heat melts off any residual thread that may remain on the upper. Then, if the model calls for it, a piece of reinforced fabric is glued to ensure that the toe never loses its shape. Molding the upper into the shape of a foot requires a stand-in foot, so to speak, called a last. There are 14 different lasts used for sizes 6 wide to 16 narrow, or 16 wide to 6 narrow. Insoles are attached to the bottom of the last and the upper stretched over the top. What comes next puts Allen Edmonds in an elite minority and helps account for why its shoes cost far more than the average pair.
That's for what we actually sold a welt to, and that's what Allen Edmonds is really known for, is our 360-degree welt construction out of this factory.
The shoe is encased in shrink-wrapped plastic.
We're protecting it from fingerprints at this point.
Because at this stage, a lot of people are going to be handling it.
A lot of people are going to handle it on down the line here.
Now it's time to sew in that all-important welt, the tough strip of leather that goes around the shoe's base.
That's not going anywhere.
No.
It's the welt that makes the shoe durable, but it's cork that puts a spring in your step.
Jim, I thought it was just going to be a strip of cork.
No, it's like a cork compound that's almost like a glue that evaporates out of there, so when it dries, it's just a layer of cork in between.
That's amazing. I thought you were going to just slap a pre-baked...
No, this is real cork.
Once the cork dries, the shoes are ready for some sole. Next, the edges of the soles are buffed until smooth. Then the shoes are run through a dryer. This tightens the leather fibers and increases durability. And at last, the last is removed. But first comes inspection. Marine drill instructors have nothing on these guys.
This is where eventually it goes in the box. What Jesse's doing there, he's actually our final inspector. We have one person on each of four lines looking at every single shoe that we make out of this factory here because we've got over 200 steps in the process.
There's a lot to like about Allen Edmonds shoes and the people who make them, not the least of which is the company's determination to stay here and put that Made in America label on each pair.
And every shoe's got a lot of soul.
It does.
Dancing shoes, dance. Ooh, ooh, they're carrying me away. Help, help.
Have you ever heard people lament of how much better life used to be before modern technology complicated things? Well, excuse me. Along with the simple life came unsanitary streets and a life expectancy averaging around 45. The same fatal maladies of earlier eras are now things we barely sneeze at. Today, heart disease is our number one killer. But even there, things are far better than they used to be, thanks in no small measure to a modern miracle that's more common than you may think, the pacemaker. Minneapolis, Minnesota may be a big city, but it has a small town feel. The pace is less hurried than Chicago, and the people are Midwest friendly. So on the surface, this might seem an unlikely place for a company whose products are devoted to eliminating death from heart disease, which is often associated with the stresses of modern life. Ironically or not, Minnesota is one of the country's major producers of medical technology. In fact, the many healthcare companies located here have been given the collective nickname Medical Alley. And the biggest kid in the alley is Medtronic. Medtronic's impressive world headquarters are a testament to the company's breathtaking success. Actually, make that breath-giving, because Medtronic makes an array of life-saving devices, from artificial heart valves to touchscreen surgical computers. Of course, like all major corporations, Medtronic didn't start off this big or this successful. The company began as small as you can get. It was in 1949 that habitual tinkerer and electrical engineer Earl Botkin, along with his brother-in-law Palmer Hermansley, founded Medtronic in a cramped Minneapolis garage. Their goal was to make a living by repairing hospital equipment, but they grossed only $8 their first month. They kept at it, though, and soon developed a reputation that spread to hospitals across the Midwest. In time, doctors began asking them for whatchamacallits and doohickeys and other needed equipment that didn't yet exist. Earl and Palmer couldn't say no. After all, that's where the fun was, and success, too. It was at the suggestion of Dr. Carl Lillehei, a pioneer in open-heart surgery, that Earl Botkin began trying to improve the primitive pacemakers of the day being 1957. The devices had been invented a few years before by doctors in Toronto to restart hearts that had stopped. Pacemakers work by giving off tiny electrical impulses that replicate the physiological ones that keep healthy hearts in rhythm. In damaged or defective hearts, the rhythm can be erratic or worse, stop completely. A pacemaker's electrical impulses are transmitted through a wire, which, back in the early days, was connected to a machine the size of a linebacker and plugged continuously into an outlet. Yes, it kept the patient alive, but the quality of life was limited. Earl's incredible contribution was the portable, transistorized, battery-powered pacemaker. It allowed the patient complete freedom of movement and a return to normalcy. The first patient to receive Medtronic's revolutionary pacemaker was 72-year-old Warren Mauston, who had been suffering from serious heart problems that nearly killed him. Thanks to Earl's little box, he felt fit and happily went on to live seven more productive years. Spurred by that success, Earl and Palmer and their now 18 employees in that old garage began building pacemakers as fast as they could with the aim of making them ever smaller, lighter, and more comfortable, and giving them batteries that could last longer than 6 weeks And bit by bit, pacemaker by pacemaker, they did. Today's pacemakers, barely 2 inches wide and powered by batteries that can last 10 years, are implanted under the skin. Some users forget that they even have one. As for Medtronic, well, the garage has given way to state-of-the-art facilities for research, testing, and production. Obviously, pacemakers are far more complicated than they used to be. Today's models work by monitoring the patient's natural heart rate and delivering electrical impulses only if necessary. So if the patient's at rest, his heart will beat more slowly, just as it'll beat more quickly during exercise. The result is a normal life. Today's pacemakers also record and store data about the patient's heart that his doctor can download and review. Some patients even send the data directly to the doctors over the internet. It's hard not to appreciate that as its pacemakers got smaller, Medtronic got larger. Today, the company has 30,000 employees who serve patients in 120 countries. How good Medtronic's people must feel knowing that what they do every day saves lives every day. True, the 3 million pacemaker patients worldwide don't all wear Medtronic pacemakers, but they all owe a debt to its company and its founders, and so do their loved ones, which means us.
Some friends and I once got on the subject of games. You know, the kinds you play in rainy afternoons. One friend and his family loved Scrabble. Another said Monopoly, and yet another said Trivial Pursuit. Turns out, though, that we all played card games. Gin Rummy, Hearts, Bridge, even poker. There's something for everybody in that deck of 52. And for that, we can thank the people who make the cards or dealt.
Named for the noble Roman general of antiquity, Cincinnati is called the Queen City of the Midwest. Located on the banks of the Ohio River, it's where the first pro baseball team began playing in 1869, the Red Stockings. Obviously, games are in the air around here, because right next door to the Queen City is the town of Norwood, home to the King of Cards, the United States Playing Card Company. No matter what the game, poker, or solitaire, or hearts, fish, whatever, the people in this factory deal nothing but winning hands by turning out 20 million cards a day. For those of you who count them, that's about 400,000 decks, or a single deck 4 miles high. So who dealt the company's first hand? CEO Greg Simcoe takes us into the founder's room.
Who's this august-looking gentleman here?
This is James Armstrong, the actual founder of the U.S. Playing Card Company. He started in 1867. These are the other two partners that originally started the firm, Robert Morgan and John Robinson.
Circuses were big business in the mid-19th century, so the founders printed circus posters. Riverboat gambling was even bigger, which meant there was a big market for playing cards. Soon, though, another fad inspired a printer's grandfather who'd been daydreaming out the shop window.
He saw all these folks riding bicycles, and he said, you know, we got to figure out a way to get in on this fad. So they named their number one product bicycle.
The origins of playing cards are murky. Some credit first millennium China, others 13th century India or Egypt. But the ancestors of today's deck probably came from France over 500 years ago.
Now, the origin of the common suits that we see today are from France in the 1400s. The hearts represented the church. The clubs represented husbandry. The diamonds represented the sword. And spades represented the knights themselves.
The standard deck is only the foundation of the business. Over the years, the company has also created specialty lines for some of its best customers, like American GIs.
That was a spotter deck from World War II. They put these out for all the GIs in the field.
So you don't shoot down the good guys.
That's right.
And for the war in Iraq, there was the most wanted deck.
GIs play cards. That's a way for them to become familiar.
With the faces.
While they're playing cards.
Of course, there's notorious and then there's notorious. Making a great deck of cards is a real balancing act. The cards have to be strong, yet flexible. Smooth, but not slippery. It's all about touch. Those intended for casinos are made under security precautions worthy of the U.S. Mint. Regardless of the use, the process begins with paper, which in this case is a blending derived from hardwoods, softwoods, and linen. The director of manufacturing, Jim Owen, oversees the high-stakes creation of the decks that will soon show up on a gaming table near you.
Now, the operators, what they're doing, they're making sure that we really control things like moisture very carefully because we want to make sure that the playing card is very consistent and that when you take it into a humid environment or dry environment, it doesn't warp on you.
John Glass has been splicing and laminating here for 38 years.
What's the machine doing?
This roll and this roll are running together up in the middle there, are getting pasted together. It comes out.
All
the other end.
Yeah,
Each card is composed of two layers that are sealed together, then laminated. Now, if you're looking for the exact formula, well, they're keeping that much up their sleeves. Tim Chandler is manager of paper converting.
This is the adhesive layer that we put in the paper on a warm side. That's kind of our little secret ingredient. It's what makes the card durable, playable. It's what helps to the shuffleability of the card.
Oh, don't forget about putting the cards in bicycle spokes, too.
Works quite well for that.
Sounds just like a motorcycle.
Yes, it does.
After the paper dries, it's off to meet the crusher, a machine that presses everything to a predetermined thickness. Once the paper has been pasted, laminated, dried, cured, crushed, and calipered, next stop is the printing press.
This is our printing operation. This is the output end of the printing press. You can see on this we have actually 54 cards and two instruction cards. And when you flip it over, what we have here is we have a four-color face.
Now the printed sheets are cut into strips, and the strips punched into cards. That's where finishing inspectors like Pat Thomas come in.
How do you know that's a bad deck?
Because it doesn't have an ad card on top. It's missing some cards.
Pat fans a sample deck from each run, inspecting for ink spots, nicks, and tears. If she finds something, she immediately pushes a button to shut down the run.
How does it feel to have all this power? Kind of like the captain of the ship, aren't you?
Yeah!
Just shut down the whole operation.
Yeah.
The decks that make it through are snap-tested, slide-tested, and rub-tested for integrity, then packaged and boxed. Finally, they're ready to deal. As in, deal them out where it counts. For instance, a friendly game of poker with the guys, or even not so friendly. Hey, is this a ringer? It's Mike Sexton, host of the World Poker Tour.
Let's get that spade.
Yeah! Oh, wow. Here we go. Come on, now we're talking. He raised 13.
I still got it.
Yeah! One of the great things about poker is that the best hand doesn't win all the pots.
Poker is the art of bluffing. The better you bluff, the more you win.
Oh. He's going for it. He's moving all in.
Wow. I got a call. I'm all in, too.
I'm going to gamble with him, too. We're all in.
Okay, let's see what we got.
Cincinnati, it's a cruel town.
In 2002, archaeologists searching for artifacts near Nevada's famed mining town in Virginia City thought they hit pay dirt underneath an old saloon. After they reassembled some shards of glass back to its original shape, they announced to the world that they had made an incredibly significant find. Why? Because they had found a 130-year-old bottle of Tabasco brand hot sauce. And if that's not significant, I'd like to know what is.
If you're a fan of spicy food, no doubt you're familiar with Tabasco's peppery kick, which has been gracing American tables since 1868. What you may not be familiar with is where that sting of fire comes from. It's actually the result of a compound called capsaicin, found in capsicum peppers. According to lore, the reason we enjoy them today is because back around 1850, a soldier who'd brought home a few peppers from the Mexican-American War gave them to a New Orleans banker named Edmund McElhenney. Edmund took the soldier's gastronomic advice and sprinkled them in his food. It tasted so delicious that he planted the remaining seeds in his family's garden on Avery Island, one of five islands along the Louisiana Gulf Coast formed by evaporating salt water. As it happens, that dome-shaped landscape of rock salt turned out to be the perfect breeding ground for these peppers, which took root and sprouted in abundance. Alas, the Civil War soon uprooted just about everything in Louisiana, including the McElhenney family. Like most Southerners, they returned home afterwards to find everything in tatters. Everything, that is, except one thing, the capsicum peppers, which still stood tall and lush in the garden. Overjoyed, Edmund quickly returned to his culinary experiments with the peppers. In one of them, he blended some mashed capsicum with a little vinegar and a grain or two of that good old Avery Island rock salt. The result was hot but not too hot, tangy but not too tangy, and improved the taste of everything it touched. To get his new sauce ready for market, all Edmund needed now was a catchy name and an eye-catching bottle, something like the old cologne bottles he kept around. Edmund realized that calling the sauce McElhenney's, for example, didn't quite capture its true nature. So when he heard someone use the word Tabasco, he didn't have to know what it meant to understand that it onomatopoetically captured the nature of his zesty condiment. Samples were rushed out, and as luck would have it, one of them reached America's largest wholesale grocer, a man who knew a tasty thing when he tasted it. Just like that, Edmund had the orders and cash flow he needed to make a real go of the business. 2 years later, in 1870, Edmund secured the patent for his Tabasco formula, which is the same one still in use today. Every pepper is allowed to ripen completely, from green to orange to that beautiful red. Not until they match the color on a stick carried by the workers are they picked. Then they're mashed and mixed according to the recipe and sealed in oak barrels for up to 3 years. Every step is supervised by at least one member of the McElhaney family. And that's a lot of supervision, considering that they turn out 750,000 bottles a day and ship to 160 countries. The nice people at Tabasco invite you to come down and see for yourself how they do what they do on a public tour. You can explore the salt mines, shop at the country store, and enjoy the picturesque landscape. So that's the story from beautiful Louisiana. Not for nothing, it seems, are the Cajuns a spicy lot.
For more about the goods that make America great, click on the Travel Channel at discovery.com.